lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black.
A lot of reporters who I have talked with are in crouching, shuddering fear of, well, you know, everyone that you're associated with has been killed. They've been saying that to me. Yeah, so I'm supposed to be crowding down. This is the United States of America. We're either slaves or we're running and controlling our government. We're either a country with a military or we're a military with a country.
You snort my good pony.
People are looking at the puppets and at the stage, not the ones behind. They are looking at phony people like Obama or Bush or whoever it is. I mean, well, these people enrich themselves. They are not the true beneficiary, the ultimate beneficiaries in this. And you don't ever get to see those entities. They never are in the center stage. They're always behind the stage.
I never took from the widows and orphans.
You're listening to episode 699 of Unwelcome Guests, A Country with a Military or a Military with a Country. I'm Robin Upton, and we just heard that turn of phrase from the lips of Scott Bennett, who continues his testimony from last episode. We're going to contrast that with the other voice, Sybelle Edmonds. So we have two American whistleblowers, both bound by obligations not to disclose particular pieces of information, but both determined, subject to that limitation, to try to inform people about what is being done in their name and with their tax dollars. Contrast the fierce sense of betrayal, the urgency of Scott Bennett, having relatively recently discovered that the powers that be are in fact funding those terrorist forces that they pretend to be opposing, and there's a lot of complicity in the commercially controlled media, the Justice Department, Senate committees. The apparatus of the state is not working the way that he thought it was working. Contrast that with more experienced whistleblower, Sybelle Edmonds, who tried to publicize the criminal activities she discovered as a translator for the FBI in the wake of 9/11, only to be subject to gag orders. She, of course, has a much more developed understanding of the deep state, a more nuanced picture of who is lying to whom. Now, she's done a lot in terms of getting the message out and developing the alternative media, but she remains frustrated about preaching to the choir, and we're going to be hearing in our second hour why she's chosen to write a novel as a way of encouraging people to look at false flag terrorism and to question the stereotypes of Islamic terrorist extremists being served up by the commercially controlled media. Now let's return to our interview from last episode. I'm going to rewind a minute or two just to give us a little bit of context.
Isn't it true that there are other Swiss banks that are also implicated in this sort of money trail?
Absolutely. And that was the beauty of Birkenfeld's material. He brought together all of the intelligence that, as an intelligence analyst, I could have laid out on a big white table and had basically the whole World War II outline of all my major targets. And those were Credit Suisse, HSBC, besides all the other European banks and Middle Eastern sub-banks and contractors that are used by the Swiss banks. He brought a wealth of material. He had worked in the Swiss banking area for like 10 years. He knew where all the bodies were buried. He knew all the major bankers and their phones, their cell phones, their hotel rooms and their calendars of events and when they come and their conferences and their clients. He had enormous a wealth of information that staggered my mind because I was just blown away. And he also had all of the WikiLeaks cables that he couldn't quite make sense of, but me and my background with him, I'm looking at them. And it just, it's like looking into one of those photographs you have to stare at for a long time, and suddenly you see the image on the other side. That was what I saw when Brad bought all this stuff to me. Suddenly I studied it, and I could see the multidimensional connections and the people and the agencies, and I was flabbergasted. I was appalled, and that's what triggered me, again, out of a sense of patriotism as an officer of the United States Army. How is this information being used to protect my enlisted soldiers on the battlefield, my Marines, my special operations, my CIA assets? How are we utilizing this?
And what about the general that you reported to or initially brought you in to Booz Allen, Jeff?
Jeff Jones.
Now he passed on at what point during this trajectory? Because he wasn't there to back you up. Is that right?
No, he had passed on in 2000 and 2000. I think it was 2010. Yeah, he had passed on before all of this had unfolded. And I think perhaps because he had passed on, that was the green light for some of the powers to be to come and prosecute me, because he would never have stood for it. He knew everybody who was the high up in the Pentagon brass, that if anything needed to be done, he could have made a quick phone call and everything would have disappeared. But I didn't think there was anything there to make disappear, and I didn't call in any of those favors. I probably should have, thinking back now after what they've done. But had I not gone through all this, I would never have met Brad Birkenfeld. And if I didn't meet Brad Birkenfeld, I wouldn't have all this Swiss banking information that's directly being used right now by ISIS and Syria and all the bad guys in the Middle East that, quote, were supposedly trying to put those fires out.
Okay, have you heard of an organization, a front organization, actually, called Pure Heart Investments?
No, not off the top of my head.
Okay. And are you able to name any other, let's say, front organizations that would have been associated with these accounts?
There's what Brad revealed to me in the materials that he had shared with me. The Optimus Foundation was a major foundation within the Union Bank of Switzerland architecture that was used for a variety of courier and money laundering. Of course, they had more technical professional names for it, money laundering transfer operations. And all of that was significant because Booz Allen Hamilton had put me through extensive training, and I had all of the materials from Booz Allen Hamilton. And this was in 2010. And when I go back through all my material, I see all of the material that Brad was mentioning was directly being utilized in the PowerPoint slides and the training that Booz Allen Hamilton was using in terrorist finance, counter-terrorist finance training. So when I met Brad, it's like I'm meeting the guy who has all of the information that Booz Allen Hamilton was directly putting into its training platforms and yet not doing anything about on a war-fighting level.
Okay, so but you must have been having sort of talks during the time when you were going through all these experiences. Did you not have any other counterintelligence officers or people maybe even above you that you tried to tell this story to?
When I submitted this report to General Jeffrey Jacobs, who was in charge of U.S. Civil Affairs Psychological Operations Command, who was my head-up general in charge of my whole combatant command, I sent it to him first. As an officer, going up my chain of command, I was adamant to make sure I was doing this through proper channels. I didn't send it to the media or anyone. I was sending it to the inspector general, military authorities, my military lawyer. After a month, nothing is being done. I then send it to the Congress, Armed Services Committee of the Senate, Armed Services Committee of the House, Terrorism Committee. I mean, in the book, I list every single member of Congress who got a copy of this. And I mean, I'm happy to read through exactly who got this.
Would this be also sent to Eric Holder directly, or would it be sent to someone who reports to him?
This was sent to the courts too. I didn't send it directly to Eric Holder. I sent it to the court because, quite honestly, after what Brad had said and what I had seen them do, I knew that they would. Trust me, the Department of Justice has a habit of mimicking the Nazis when it comes to treating prisoners, and I have seen men die in the federal prison camp of heart attacks. I've seen men lose their legs because they're left to the medical neglect. People do not understand how tragically horrific the Department of Justice and the Bureau of Prisons is to people when you're in prison. One side note. Another very, and I've shared with you, I think, before, when I was released, I was just released in February. Now, I had been writing everybody for 2 years. I sat down at a typewriter and sent out every piece of mail I possibly could. Nothing was responded to. Nothing was done. The only person who came up was Michael Isikoff. Now, this is significant. Michael Isikoff of NBC News and Tom Hamburger of The Washington Post had come up to interview me. Based on the Navy contractor who went to the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. and shot up the Navy Yard, if you remember that.
Yes.
Well, he had been gotten a security clearance, and they were questioning his clearance. Well, anyway, they sent me a letter saying, we'd like to interview you about security clearances. And I said, certainly, come up. And Tom Hamburger and Michael Isikoff came up, and I shared with them this entire story, which I'm sharing with you, and showed them all the documentation. And said, this is, you know, a bizarre tragedy and no one is doing anything. Please get the story out. And I also said, you know, what's interesting on your security clearance issue is Booz Allen Hamilton is owned by the Carlyle Group. Carlyle Group also owns USIS, which gives security clearances. Hmm. So the Carlyle Group owns the company that gives the security clearances and it owns the company that gets the security clearances, that needs security clearances. So it's like, you know, they own both entities. And no one, and I wrote all members of Congress, again, over 2 years on all these issues that I knew about, hoping that someone was going to say, well, you know, what have you got to say? That, you know, what do you know? And I reported that to Isikoff and Tom Hamburger saying, look into this. No one else is reporting that USIS and Carlyle Group and Booz Allen Hamilton are all, you know, incestuously connected. And for 2 hours, they sat down with me and they then left, you know, and the next thing I know, they wrote a story on clearances and had like three sentences devoted to our meeting conversation in which they basically said, Bennett is another contractor who's in prison. Not any discussion of why he's in prison, not any discussion of the propaganda and the illegality and the unconstitutionality of him. He's a military officer. No, nothing like that. It right. was quickly abandoned. Now, Michael Isikoff had also attacked Jesselyn Raddick. Jesselyn Raddick, who represents Snowden and also represented Birkenfeld. Jesselyn Raddick had originally come out in her challenges against the Justice Department for their behavior against the U.S. Afghanistan citizen, the U.S. kid, I can't remember his name, but just they had gone and violated his rights. And Jesselyn Raddick had stood up and said, you're doing unconstitutional activities. And they had come against Jesselyn Raddick for that. And Michael Isikoff had attacked her and written a variety of nonsense about her. So anyway, that's an interesting connection that Michael
Isikoff... Well, I think Hastings was also doing a story on that that young man.
Yeah. Hastings was the man who had the courage and the gumption and the fearlessness, probably based on a lot of his Canadian, you know, spirit and upbringing. He didn't have the beaten down fear of the American government as perhaps, you know, Americans have. He came at it much more, you know, just battling the war drum. And he received the whole story and the reports on the UBS, Switzerland, counterterrorism threat finance, Snowden connection, and was putting together the story. Matt Taibbi had also been educated in this. And as we know, history shows shortly after, Michael Hastings was taken out of the picture. Now, I do have, if you wanted to hear all the people that received copies of this report, so they have nowhere, you know, to go. General James Amos, Marine Corps, Commandant of the Pentagon, Senator John Coburn, Senator James Inhofe, Senator John Thune, Senator Kelly Ayotte, Representative Dave Reichhardt, Representative Ruppersberger, Senator Saxby Chambliss, Senator Jim Risch, Senator Angus King, Representative Jeff Sessions, Senator Pat Roberts, Senator Orrin Hatch, Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Dana Rohrabacher, Representative Michelle Bachmann, Representative Michael McCall, Representative Henry Waxman, Representative Eric Cantor, Representative John Boehner, Senator Mitch McConnell, Senator Rand Paul, the only one to respond again.
Okay, but there was also a problem with Rand Paul in the sense that he did respond, but it actually didn't go anywhere.
He didn't do anything, yeah. Now, I'll chalk that up to political calculation, and he's preparing for the presidency and all that, but that's still inexcusable. It's still inexcusable that the totality of this material has not been thoroughly exposed, examined, and brought in front of a congressional hearing. And that was really the whole plan that Brad and I had sat down. I said, Brad, when you get out, you really need to take this military dimension, this special operations, psychological warfare, special forces dimension, and take it to the United States Congress to say, this material you need to examine. The American taxpayer needs to examine because it is funding terrorism right now. And his plan was to get out, reappear in front of the Senate and say, here's all this material, but don't talk to me about the terrorist financing dimension. Bring in Scott Bennett, Lieutenant Scott Bennett, United States Army, who I met in prison, who worked in this capacity as a terrorist analyst with a top secret clearance for Booz Allen Hamilton. Bring him into the room and let's talk together and we'll share all this information. That was the plan from the beginning and it never happened.
Okay. Now, I have a person who's asked a question here, and what it is does your top secret clearance delegations, or I mean, so, I'm sorry, top secret security clearance obligations override your oath to the Constitution? And this is, on a certain level, it's philosophical, because you have to weigh these two, you know, these two obligations, basically.
Yeah. Well, the easy answer is, of course, anything that's a violation of the U.S. Constitution is not law. Anything that violates the U.S. Constitution is not a security clearance. It's like saying someone was murdered in cold blood under a secrecy issue, and it was illegal, it was a murder, but because it's a secrecy issue, it can't be reported. Well, the Constitution would say, no, that's not covered, that's not an issue. So I think Snowden's lawyers have articulated that in a very successful way, that the simple answer is anything that violates the U.S. Constitution is not protected under the secrecy laws. Now, that being said, I have made painstaking efforts and have throughout my entire journey of this, and including this interview, have not divulged anything that is of a TSSCI nature that was not given to me and put to me while I was in the SCIFs at State Department, Special Operations, or U.S. Central Command. So I have gone out of my way not to violate any of my security oaths. And what's amazing is Snowden sort of picked up on this too. If you go the route of filing it up the chain of command, you'll be in prison and it'll take 2 years before you meet with a reporter and talk about it, which is exactly what they've done to me.
Okay. Now I'm going to allow the questions from the audience here and asking them, as I do this, what I do every time, which is basically ask them to put their questions in all caps. I assume you may have been asking questions during this. It's quite an extensive dialogue, but if you could now put your questions in the chat, one right after the other in all caps, it will be helpful for me to go down the list and just read them as we go. But in the meantime, what I wanted to ask you was, first of all, have you been in contact with Snowden at all? Are you able to be in contact with him through any channels?
Well, I really think it's probably prudent for the eyes and ears that are listening in and watching this who are not inclined to protect a lot of the liberties or are more inclined to the super state, police state impulse. I think it's probably prudent not to divulge my communications with Snowden or any other party at this point, for their safety as well as mine, is just not giving them more information. That will come out eventually, and it's just being coordinated properly.
Okay. Now, there's another aspect to this that I find interesting, and this is going way back, and I'm sort of asking for your take on what you think about this. It would appear that since you served under the Bush administration, kind of, I'm assuming that you didn't try to push the envelope too much there. You didn't make a name for yourself the way you certainly were doing later on. You seem to come forward as somebody that they would trust as being on the same page as them. Hence, Rumsfeld seeing you, ask some good questions on some level, being on the same page and having bought, sort of drunk the Kool-Aid in the sense that you saw the Arab, the Arabs as the enemy, or the Muslim, whatever you want to call that. In other words, you seem to be right on the right page at that point. You've gone through an incredible sort of trajectory, which is, it's very rich material for a movie, let me say that. But the thing that comes to mind is that it seems that they would have perhaps misinterpreted who you really were within your, what appeared to be a sort of a conservative Bush, excuse the language, but flunky, doing the right job at the right time, kind of got, drinking the Kool-Aid, as I'm saying. And then suddenly you get put in a position where you actually can run with something and get your teeth into something, and you actually show yourself for who you really are. And that becomes a horse of a different color, somebody that they never wanted to let into their secrets.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was too late for them.
Yeah. I think that's an accurate assessment. I think you've got your finger on that. I think there was a sense in the military and in the intelligence community where you come in and you're boiled slowly. You're boiled slowly in indoctrination. You're boiled slowly in the career path. You're enriched. You're given all sorts of stability and permanency and job. And to a lot of men and women, that becomes an addictive, irresistible temptation. And they just don't have the desire and the impulse to rock the boat. I am not temperamentally prone to conflicts and fights, and I don't look for things to challenge and be problematic to. But as an old Korean War vet told me one time, he said, "Scott, it's in your DNA to challenge bullshit." And it's probably based on my, Scottish upbringing and temperament. And when I see something that's wrong and that is it just strikes me, my hair stands on end, and I do go and attack it. And I did a little of this in the Bush administration. I saw, for example, California child support agencies charging fathers 10% on arrearages and not telling them that they were due in any arrearages. And on a $50,000 debt, suddenly the father who's paying $500 a month for 10 years, thinking that he's 1 month away from paying it off, is told, "Oh, you've just been paying the interest." And the father says, "Oh, I was never informed about that." And next thing you know, the powers that be in the state of California and other states have got him between a rock and a hard place. And you have a lot of fathers that kill themselves or disappear, and all sorts of tragic stuff happens. Well, I discovered that and reported it up the Bush administration, and reported it to Senator Sam Brownback, who was on the Hill that was running a lot of this, and nothing was done, and it was covered up and buried. So that was sort of my first experience in, quote, whistleblowing. And it wasn't, it wasn't meant to get attention or anything. It was meant to fix an error, fix something that was wrong. That when I came out of the Heritage Foundation, we did a lot of sociological analysis into the stability of families directly correlating to the safety and stability of the United States. So here's an example of the United States government doing destructive things to families and fathers and children's lives that can be easily fixed, but yet it was not fixed and was covered up. And I was sort of yelled at and screamed at and went through all sorts of stuff by the Bush people that were in charge. And so I didn't have a – I wasn't a Kool-Aid drinking Republican, even though, you know, I was, and I worked in the Republican National Committee and worked at Heritage and all sorts of conservative organizations. But I had ruffled some feathers there. And then – but I kept moving up the chain of command, and Colonel Jones had hired me because he saw that ability, and he told me, I want you because you're not afraid of anyone and you're not going to kowtow and you're not going to be loyal to anything. You're going to go in and you're going to fight. You're going to identify problems. You're going to devise solutions, and you're going to do it in a bone tearing manner. And I like that, and I want that. Join my team. And he pursued me for a few months, and finally I said, you know what, I'll join your team. And that's when we started devising incredible psychological warfare material, and a lot of which has been utilized. But then I also started discovering a lot of the failures. And the thing that's significant about this is, you know, we find ourselves now into an evolving war, and this very quickly can be overpowering and destructive to the United States, because you've went around and stirred up every hornet's nest in the Middle East, hoping that you're going to be able to calm them into becoming little Democrats, sprinkle the fairy dust of capitalism and institutions. And we've miscalculated the whole Muslim identity and the romanticism that they associate with jihad and heroism and fighting for their religious call. We have failed because we've never engaged them on the psychological warfare level and articulated the Islamic religion in a way that evaporates the Wahhabist myth. We've never done that because we've been afraid to touch the religious dimension. And that's sad, because that's the only way to defeat them. And at the same time, it's like you have bureaucrats in uniform in the political circles that don't want to extinguish the fire. They just want to dampen down the flames, but keep it going so that they have a job and so that they can move on to their next career post in a military generalship, or retire and jump right into Booz Allen Hamilton.
Well, we would also say fuel the war machine.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Keep the war machine afloat and generating money, because war makes money.
And I did not join the war machine to be part of the machine. I joined the war machine to put the war out of business, to end it, to end the enemy, to defeat them, and come home. As General Maximus in Gladiator, I went up to Germania to fight it, to win it, and come home to my crops. And the problem was, nobody wants to do that. They wanted to simply continue it and grow
fan
it.
Fan the flames.
And that's enormously dangerous, because suddenly we wake up and we're in a police state. Suddenly, right, half of our constitutional liberties are gone. Suddenly, the Department of Justice is now prosecuting a military officer in a civilian court for things that were done on base, that subsequently other courts have been throwing out similar cases, but it's very disturbing. So the whole point of this is to educate people about, okay, what's been done, and hopefully bring all this together to hold people accountable.
Okay, now you've mentioned Wahhabism, and there's also the money trail that goes to funding terrorists and also training those terrorists, from what I understand, in Saudi Arabia. And the links between the Bush administrations, as we know very well, and Saudi Arabia. But this trail of money must implicate certain countries more than others. And Saudi Arabia has to be, you know, way high on the list. Isn't that true?
Well, I think other open source media analysis have very accurately identified some of the key countries that are involved with this whole funding of jihadist terrorist impulses. And those, you know, RT Today has done a lot of significant stories into the Sunni countries, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, not so much Yemen and Somalia, they're crumbling already. But you've got very wealthy states that are basically a lot of very rich people that are giving money away to individuals and organizations, a lot of which are based in Europe, that are funding through Swiss banks, that are directly plugging into the pipeline of terrorist recruitment.
Okay, when you're saying based in Europe, is there any particular European country that they're based in more often than not?
Well, that was what Brad Birkenfeld had divulged, that Switzerland and the Union Bank of Switzerland and Credit Suisse and HBSE and The whole Swiss banking establishment was, in Brad's argument, was the quintessential center point, the choke point that needed to be properly controlled, and Department of Treasury in coordination and synchronicity with the military and, quote, supposedly, you would have expected CIA, needed to coordinate the constriction of the bank accounts that were being opened, that were flowing into these countries and these individuals. So his argument was UBS, in his background, was a major hub for finances that were coming out.
Right. But what about Germany, for example? What about Germany?
Well, you have in those countries a lot of terrorist organizations, terrorist individuals who are sympathetic with the cause that are using soapboxes for rallying and recruiting. I mean, you see that with the reports of 3,000 British or 3,000 Europeans, big segments coming from Britain and Germany, all joining the Syrian jihad. So the human capital is coming out of the exodus of the Islamic dual citizens, if you will. Their citizenship may be in Germany, maybe in France, maybe in Britain, but their passion and loyalty and spiritual connection is with their Middle Eastern Muslim identity, and specifically their sense of jihad, their sense of, and there was a Mozambique, I think it was, who came out, who was released from Britain today, and he appeared on Julian Assange's talk show, had come out, and him and another individual were articulating the Islamic jihad theory and why a lot of these people are moving into the Middle East, you know, Sunni Islamic State. And it's not for economic stability. It's not for having condos in a nice piece of property in the Middle East. It's for the thrill and the fulfillment and the promise of eternity in heaven for fighting jihad and all that goes along with it. That's why they're going over there. That's why they're fighting. And the dollars that are being funded to buy them the guns, the ammo, the uniforms, the food, buy them the wives. There's a massive exodus of females from the European countries and Islamic who are going over there as part of this Disneyland exodus. The Middle Eastern Islamic State fighting of Syria and Iraq, that's the Disneyland for these people who are wound up and excited and want fulfillment. And they don't equate fulfillment with the material enrichment of the European Western society. They attribute fulfillment through their sense of living as, you know, representatives of, you know, God's will.
So right. But in a sense, you can relate as a soldier. They see themselves as warriors for Allah, so to speak.
Yeah.
For their spiritual beliefs, unlike
that's the whole reason
Christian
that the Iraqi
Christians.
Forces are crumbling is because there is no, in fact, there's a prohibition of the spiritual purpose of them standing on Humvees, defending against the Sunnis that are coming in. There's no similar zeal that the Iraqi military forces have. And the sense that we're going to go in and train moderate, non-religious, zealot entity people to topple Assad and to topple the ISIS state, the notion of that is either so devoid of any common sense logic, and the people who are thinking that need to be fired, if not thrown into an insane asylum, or it's a purposeful cover-up just to continue this endless war. Because, you know, all of a sudden, if you're the man with a fly swatter and you're getting paid for every fly, the last thing you want is for all the flies to go into some hive and settle down. You want them to be stirred up. You want them to be flying all over the place. They're not that dangerous. They're easy to take out. Now, airstrikes and all that, that's silly. The only way that you're going to battle these people is from inside out. You're going to go into their hearts and minds as an Islamic thinker and articulate for them, like Sayyid Imam did, the truth that they will not get to heaven by engaging in this sort of behavior. And in fact, Sayyid Imam, which is a brilliant Islamic scholar, which we were all influenced by at the State Department, has basically said the entire radical Wahhabist Al-Qaeda modus operandi is un-Islamic. And these people are risking their eternal salvation by following it. And that right there, from an Islamic scholar, that is a strategy that we should have been directly imposing into all of our psychological warfare, strategic communications, messaging throughout the whole Middle East.
Okay, very good. At this moment, I'm going to go down some questions, and then we're going to try to wrap this up because it's been going on for quite a while, and you've been amazing, just, you know, really very, very disciplined and delivering all of this so clearly. I don't think anyone will have a problem understanding what it is you're trying to get across here. So that's great. Okay, someone wants to know... Al Jazeera, would they, it appears they're trying to ask the question, has Al Jazeera been interested in the story?
Al Jazeera has not contacted me and has examined this. As I've said, you're the first intrepid reporter who has had the courage to take on this. I mean, a lot of reporters who I have talked with are in crouching, shuddering fear of, well, you know, everyone that you're associated with has been killed. They've been saying that to me. Yeah, so I'm supposed to be crowding down. This is the United States of America. We're either slaves or we're running and controlling our government. We're either a country with a military, or we're a military with a country. And we need to be, you know, the former. We are a country, the United States of America, where freedom and liberty is the envy of every human being on the face of the planet, and with that, you know, every notion of freedom and capitalism and letting your imagination and earning the fruits of your labor. We're either a country that defends that, or we're a country of a police state, slaves, where everybody lives in fear and they're persecuted by the Justice Department and thrown in prison, and the military, CIA, apparatus, we're cowering from them. No, I'm not going to live like that. I'm not going to cower down to anything. I will present the truth that was presented to me by Birkenfeld to anyone, any person in Congress, anyone in the military uniform, anyone in the military intelligence community, because my motivation has been the men and women in uniform and their families who are on this path of endless war and that are suffering and dying. Now, I am not saying we need to completely pack our bags and leave with our tail between our legs and allow the Middle East Islamic terrorist state to consolidate and claim victory and follow and attack us in any way. I am all about victory and winning and doing it, but doing it intelligently. And that's where we've sort of lost track, and it's very dangerous. But a lot of professors, a lot of congressmen, and a lot of media people have all ran away from this and have not talked about it. Now, I think now that this is now getting out, that they can actually hear and question and see that everything's documented. You can go to Birkenfeld and he will confirm everything that I've said. You can go to Snowden and he will confirm everything that I've said. You can go to Jessalyn Raddick and she will confirm everything that was said. The question is, will they? Are they, you know, have they been gotten to? It's very significant that a Vanity Fair reporter is messaged by the CIA substation chief telling him not to do any Birkenfeld story. Why? Well, because of all the bank accounts.
Well, I mean, The Guardian, Greenwald, Russia TV obviously is stepping forward. They have an agenda that would allow for this kind of disclosure. So in theory, you'll be going to them next.
Well, let me just point out, I when I first got out of prison, I immediately started writing and contacting every media entity I could, and including that everybody at Fox News. Let me just put that right out there. I wrote Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, Monica Crowley, Charles Krauthammer, Roger Ailes, everybody that you could, imagine who was associated with Fox News. I wrote, and not a single one of them did anything, even did any sort of response. And it flabbergasted me. I thought, how in the world could you be representing the Constitution and freedom, and then you have Swiss banks and government corruption and cover-up and all this stuff that you're not even going to examine and ask questions about? That's your whole role. Or is your role just to be a pom-pom cheerleader for the endless war on terrorism so that you have a, you know, a job? You know, flash news alert. We've got a Homeland Security warning of orange level code. Stay tuned for details. That's what it sadly and disgustingly seems to have evolved into. But let me point out, I did reach out through RT today. I reached out to Abby Martin, who I think is very respectful, and she's a personality that may deal with something like this. I haven't heard back from others in there that I've reached out to. But let me just applaud you for being the person who has uncorked the genie in a lot of respects and gotten this out to the American public. And I would hope that, you know, this answers a lot of questions. I'm more than happy to follow up and do any sort of, you know, post-interview analysis or discussion as times go on, because this is a very important issue that can help shape our future geopolitical decisions in the November election and beyond. Every single person I would encourage to pick up the book that's on the website to really read through this, because among other things, there's three books up there. There's Shell Game, then there's the Letters to Congress. And in that book is a letter, every single letter that was ever sent out to members of Congress and the military. So people can see that clearly all these members of Congress were communicated with, were given this material, and they did nothing. They need to be held to account in the elections. That's, as we as Americans, that's how we hold our politicians to account. We are not people here to serve you and to keep you inflamed with a job. You are in a position of political power to take these sorts of materials and revelations and intelligence failures and do something about them and basically keep our soldiers safe and avoid us going into endless wars where, you know, you could do something about it. They should have taken all of these bank accounts when Brad Birkenfeld brought them, and we would never have the problem that we have right now. That's absolutely the sad reality of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, another question. Who were the other Dov Zakheim key associates at Booz Allen Hamilton?
Well, Dov Zakheim was the man in charge of the Booz Allen Hamilton terrorist threat finance contract down at U.S. Central Command. Bill Lubliner was another immediate manager. Troy Hensley was another manager. Mike Maravilla. And there was a few others. You know, it's all contained in the book. One interesting thing about Booz Allen Hamilton that no one really knows and talks about is that Booz Allen Hamilton in the McLean, Virginia headquarters has an entire floor where all of the top secret documents of the United States government can be couriered over and stored. So you have a civilian contractor that has the capability of taking every top secret SCI document out of various military intelligence agencies, and Booz Allen Hamilton has contracts with every intelligence and combatant command and State Department agency. They theoretically have the ability to take those documents out of the United States government and store them into the Booz Allen Hamilton McLean office. Now, that's very disconcerting to me that that material is up there in a private contracting firm. It flabbergasted me. And then you have, well, I mean, the politicians today talking about taking the NSA material out of, you know, storing it with a third party. Well, we've already been doing that. Booz Allen Hamilton is a prime example of a third party who's got top secret documents. And Edward Snowden would confirm that.
Absolutely. We haven't talked about this, but did Birkenfeld talk about the link to the City of London, to the British, you know, because there's a direct link that we know of that goes from the NSA to the GCHQ in Britain. And for all intents and purposes, they work hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And this has been shown to me, and I've also investigated it. So did Birkenfeld sort of talk about that at all? Because we've also got the Brits who are, you know, I mean, obviously we've got, you know, that population that is working with America to get embroiled in these wars, supposedly not sending troops on the ground or necessarily, but they're certainly hand in glove with America and the agenda to go over into Syria where we're bombing right now, et cetera. So was there a money trail going through the Swiss banks, going through England that he spoke about, you know, in that regard?
Well, I won't go on to try and talk about things that I'm not an expert in. Birkenfeld really was the expert in all of the Swiss banking operations throughout the world, in London, in the United States, in Switzerland, in Germany. They were not really, well, I won't go too much into what he described Britain's role in it. I would probably defer a lot of that because I don't want to misquote him and misstate anything. I would encourage everyone who has questions to file a letter, Freedom of Information Act request to Brad Birkenfeld, care of Cohen and Colapinto in Washington, D.C., as well as Jesselyn Raddick at the Government Accountability Project, and make the question direct to her and to them, and simply state, I'm curious about Brad Birkenfeld and his revelations about terrorist financing through Union Bank of Switzerland to Lieutenant Scott Bennett, United States Army. Can you provide me more data? Can you provide me information? Can you provide me the answers about Swiss banks being connected through London and Britain and other agencies, and see what the response is? That's really the sunshine that all of your listeners and every American really needs to do. I'm speaking to a Republican group of women in a couple of days, and they're very interested about, well, what, you know, why is this significant? What can we do? Well, the American patriot, the American listener, and I think all of the people who pay attention to your show are particularly intellectual and sophisticated and adept to say, how does this influence my country, my freedom, my government? And I've laid out very clearly what's happened to me and happened to Birkenfeld can happen to you. It can happen to anyone. It's happened to Joe Nachio. It's astounding. It almost happened to Snowden. He picked up and ran forth. It's happened to Assange, except they haven't been able to get him. You need to take this information and go to your members of Congress and say, why didn't you respond to this? What have you done about it? And put a Freedom of Information request into your member of Congress. Pick up, you know, the book and the list of everybody who's been contacted and say, I'm requesting what your information is on this subject matter. What have you done about it? What has your response been? Because that's where we have to hold these members of Congress accountable. Otherwise, they're being paid off by the UBS powers and by the, you know, a lot of the Booz Allen Hamilton connection with Dov Zakheim and others has been the American Israeli Political Action Committee. There's been a lot of talk that the Israeli intelligence Mossad is infiltrated and riddled throughout Booz Allen Hamilton. There's some brilliant people who have articulated that. That I don't need to go through, but American citizens should take that to their member of Congress and question them about
it. Okay. And did you notice this to be the case when, I mean, what I was kind of interested in was Dov Zakheim, you talked about this amount of money that somehow disappeared on his watch, which is the $3 or $4 trillion, whatever, something around that. And I'm not sure if that's the same, you know, chunk of money that Rumsfeld said, oh, I'm sorry, we lost it, it disappeared.
Yeah, that's exactly the amount of money. Donald Rumsfeld, who appeared on September 10th, 2001, and said we're missing $2.3 trillion. One day later was September 11th, and conveniently, all of the auditors that were working on that money tracking operation were in a naval intelligence skiff in the section of the Pentagon that was destroyed. Barbara Honegger has done a wonderful analysis proving, I think, without a shadow of doubt, that one, it wasn't a 757 that crashed into that Pentagon. It was a drone that was militarized, and that there were internal detonations that occurred. And that could only have been pre-planned in some way coordinated that resulted in the death of all the auditors that were tracking this money. Dov Zakheim, that was his watch. He was in charge of that. Now, what's interesting, too, is Dov Zakheim was also connected to SPS, which was a firm in New York, which ran the automated plane remote control technology devices that a lot of people who have studied a lot of the September 11th issues have stated the theory that the planes that were crashed were controlled by remote control, that had remote control devices on the bottom of the fuselage. Well, Dov Zakheim ran the company that developed that sort of technology. Booz Allen Hamilton has an entire development of technology and devices that should be also examined that aren't by the United States Congress. So Dov Zakheim's at the Pentagon overseeing the money. Before that, he was SPS, remote control plane technology, and he was also at the Heritage Foundation. I was at the Heritage Foundation. He then joins Booz Allen Hamilton and goes right into the contract at McGill Air Force Base, tracking down the terrorist money sources and the money banks. That's where he called me in to join the team. Now, what I think they thought, as you've correctly, I think, identified, they thought I was going to play the game. They thought I was going to go down and do whatever I was told, that I had been sufficiently lobotomized, quote, indoctrinated under the military rubric, and that I wouldn't ask questions. And that just wasn't my nature. I went in to solve problems, fix issues, and win a war. I was not loyal to my defense contractor firm, Booz Allen Hamilton. I was loyal to the United States government, the Constitution, pardon me, the United States Constitution. And I had a general affection and desire to save men and women who were in uniform, who were overseas fighting. And there was that was my whole motivation for joining Booz Allen Hamilton, and as well as joining the military.
Okay.
But Dov Zakheim has some interesting connections. And all the paperwork that I have, you see Dov Zakheim all over it. He was the one who hired me. He was also the one who fired me.
Okay, but McChrystal also has some kind of connection with that group. You actually said he was involved in that group.
So Stanley McChrystal was closely associated with some of the personnel that we had at Booz Allen Hamilton, who were all ex-military, Marine Corps, Army, Delta Force. Stanley McChrystal had communicated to certain members of our team who were high up on the professional level that anything they wanted, anything they needed, he would provide and facilitate. And it was sort of a working man's close relationship, I think.
Those two generals would be working together.
General McChrystal would be, he was closely associated with Troy Hensley. Troy Hensley was a Delta Force Booz Allen Hamilton guy who had told me when I was first stopped, oh, don't worry, this will all go away. We'll get you on another contract. And the next thing I know is I'm contacted by Dov Zakheim and told, we're going to remove you from the firm. So Troy Hensley was a good guy, ex-Delta Force. I think he may have left the firm. A lot of the guys had left after that. I think they got wind that there was some funny business going on. But Dov Zakheim's all over my paperwork, and I think it's more to follow.
Okay. Somebody's asking about Long Westerland. I don't know what that's about.
Yeah, I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay, but are you understanding that there is, that makes some sense, that name? Is that a name? A person's name?
Oh, sure, Linda. It's ringing some bells, but I can't quite.
Yeah, the Westerlund part, I think I've seen somewhere, but I don't know what they're referring to. So maybe the person could explain in text here if they want more answers. Somebody's saying, what about John Pearson at the DIA? Do you know anything about him?
Well, Defense Intelligence Agency is the equivalent of the Central Intelligence Agency, only run by the military. It's to do the same operations that the CIA does, but for military persons. I won't go into who I worked with within DIA, but it's a significant player and organization. I think Colonel Jones had it right when he identified the DIA was our only hope to get a lot of the material that CIA has into the military hands of commanders, because CIA hadn't been doing it, and Birkenfeld is a prime example. They weren't doing it, but DIA couldn't gain a lot of this information. One thing that struck me that's an interesting Pandora's box to open in the future is that if Osama bin Laden had been, and I say that with a very high if he was taken in Afghanistan and all of his computers and financial information was taken by the Central Intelligence Agency and put on a boat when they took him out from the country, all of that information, bank account, computer technology that was taken at the time should have immediately gone to DIA and the military, because it would have divulged all of the Swiss bank accounts that Birkenfeld had brought to the Department of Justice years prior. So all of the, and we know
okay,
for a fact.
You are maybe, I mean, not knowledgeable of the fact that Osama bin Laden was a CIA agent,
yeah,
was trained by them, and or you know that trail, but do you also know that he was taken out in like 2001, I think it was? So that this thing, this whatever operation was in going on, I mean, you understand the insides. Basically, that whole Navy SEAL operation in which then later all those SEALs died under very mysterious circumstances. They were all put on the same helicopter, which never happens, or whatever it was. The whole team was Team 6, I think they called it. SEAL Team 6 was taken out. Very mysterious operation that. So they wouldn't talk, actually, about what they found at that sort of place where there had to be some kind of actor being playing dead or whatever it was. But that's what we were just addressing. And you were saying that the Swiss bank accounts, if that had been a real operation, and if they really did uncover computers and this and that and the other, there would have been a money trail that would have been documented on those computers that links up with Birkenfeld's Swiss bank accounts, correct?
It would have been contained in Brad Birkenfeld's original 19,000 accounts that he brought to the Department of Justice and Senator Carl Levin and Senator John McCain's permanent subcommittee on investigations. All of Birkenfeld's materials would have been contained in any computer apparatus controlled by Osama bin Laden at that juncture. And, of course, we know that a different story has been crafted.
While in the streets of all our fears, they reign supreme.